This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, June 12th, 2014. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. The KUAF Summer Jazz Series welcomes the jazz fusion group The Yellow Jackets Saturday, June 21st at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium. As part of the 16th annual series, the Grammy Award-winning Yellow Jackets will perform their high-energy mix of jazz, funk, and blues. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society presents the Summer Jazz Series. Tickets available online at theod.org.
The 64th annual Opera in the Ozarks is June 20th to July 18th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs. The 2014 productions include Into the Woods, Cozy Fan Tutte, Johnny Skike, and Soir Angelica. Performances will be held at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville June 29th and July 6th, 11th, and 14th. Tickets and more information available at opera.org.
Ahead on Ozarks at Large, the names of some publications, like Time or Southern Living, give readers a literal idea as to what's written on their pages. But what about 3W or Due South? We look at the thought behind some of the names of a few of the magazines published in our region.
Plus, Kyle talks to Roby Brock about the repercussions of Tuesday's primary runoff elections. But first, according to a report released yesterday, Arkansas has the highest percentage of workers in the nation that would be affected by raising the minimum wage. The nonprofit group Oxfam America says that raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour would help more than 25% of workers. But UALR economist Michael Packow argues a uniform nationwide increase doesn't account for regional variances.
The most expensive places to live are places like Washington, D.C., New York, California. Those are also the places with the highest average wages. Arkansas is one of the lowest wage states in the nation, but it's also among the lowest cost of living states in the nation. So part of those differences tend to level things out.
Oxfam America President Raymond Offenheiser says the proposed federal increase to $10.10 an hour is based on what the wage's peak real value would be if it kept up with the cost of living since 1968. Offenheiser says it makes sense even with regional differences.
There's very few areas in the country where a minimum wage worker can afford a two-bedroom apartment, whether it's in, you know, in New York or it's in Arkansas. And what I think the Federal Reserve has commented on is that there's very little evidence that a uniform federal minimum wage applied across states with differential cost of living is actually going to have an inflationary effect.
The report suggests that three of Arkansas's four congressional districts are among the top 25 in the country that would be impacted. Workers in the 4th Congressional District would be particularly affected by any change in the minimum wage. Overall, the district has the 7th highest concentration of low-wage workers and the 4th highest concentration of low-wage female workers in the nation.
The city of Springdale will soon begin work on a new mountain bike trail after the city council accepted a grant for the project this week. Patty Christie, the city's planning director, says the 2 to 3 mile trail will be built near North Silent Grove Road. She says the trail wouldn't be moving forward without substantial support through the matching grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
The grant is for $825,051. It is to be matched with the same amount from the city. $501,254 of that is actually the value of the land that was purchased by Springdale Water Utilities a few years ago, and that is going to be deeded to the city to use for the mountain bike trail. So, and then the actual cash that the city of Springdale has to put up is $323,797, which makes a total project of $1,650,102.
The soft surface trail, which will be the first mountain bike trail in the city, will be connected via a paved trail to the Lake Springdale Trailhead and the Razorback Regional Greenway. Christie says construction is moving forward on both sections of the greenway that run through the city of Springdale.
If you start at Lake Fayetteville on the south and coming up Powell Street to downtown Springdale, that one's under construction. The other portion, which starts at Johnson Road and goes north up to Lake Springdale, is under construction. And the one around north of Lake Springdale up to and going underneath 540 at Apple Blossom, it's getting close to being substantially complete. The section through downtown, we're in the process of having asbestos removed from the buildings and hope to go to construction on it as part in August. But it wasn't part of the federally funded grant.
Christie says part of the trail is being funded as part of the larger downtown revitalization project.
Earlier this week, Main Street, Arkansas announced that Fayetteville has joined the growing list of cities that are part of the Arkansas Downtown Network. Greg Phillips, the director of Main Street Arkansas, says what that means is that any businesses or building owners in the designated downtown area are eligible to receive free assistance from the statewide Main Street program.
So let's say if there's a property owner or building owner that needs help with his or her building, whether it's just suggestions about a new awning or there's some issues with the building, they're wanting to replace windows and they need help with that, we have people that can go in and consult with those folks and help them in those situations, even do facade renderings to show what the building could look like. Our interior designer can do AutoCAD drawings. So if there's a vacancy and someone is wanting to put a business in but needs help with the layout of the business, particularly, let's say, a restaurant or some sort of office space, she can do that, and it's all free of charge to those people.
Phillips says while both Downtown Network and Main Street programs throughout the state receive technical assistance from Main Street Arkansas, there are a couple of differences between the two types of organizations.
All of our certified Main Street cities are 501c3 organizations and have either full-time or part-time staffing with a board of directors and a required set budget. Our Arkansas Downtown Network cities, we do not require them to have as large of a budget. We do not require them to have paid staff, although some of them do because they have seen the necessity and the importance of that. And then the other differentiation is our Arkansas Downtown Network cities are not eligible for any Main Street grants, just our Main Street cities.
With the new Fayetteville Downtown Network, the city joins cities like Fort Smith, Heber Springs, and Clarksville that are already a part of the Arkansas Downtown Network.
Tyson Foods was recently cited for a wastewater violation from the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. According to thecitywire.com, the department cited Tyson in connection with the improper disposal of a feed additive that resulted in a fish kill along a six-mile stretch of Clear Creek in Monette. Tyson reportedly received a shipment of wastewater containing the liquid animal feed supplement Alamet from another company facility in Aurora, Missouri. Tyson pretreated the wastewater at its own facility and later discharged the water to the city of Monette's sewer system, which in turn caused operational problems at the city's wastewater facility. Those problems led to a discharge into a tributary of Clear Creek by the Monette Municipal Wastewater Treatment Facility. The city was also cited by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources for failing to operate and maintain facilities in compliance with the Missouri Clean Water Law.
Bella Vista has again been ranked as one of the top places to live. USA Today recently listed the city of more than 26,000 residents as one of the nation's top retirement destinations, along with other burgs like Blacksburg, Virginia, and downtown Knoxville, Tennessee.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals will try to rebound from a 1-0 loss at Springfield last night with another game against the Cardinals in Missouri tonight. The Nats return to Arvest Ballpark in Springdale Sunday night.
A former Arkansas Razorback pitcher continues to put together a spectacular season for the Houston Astros. Last night, Dallas Keuchel earned his 8th win of the season for Houston, pitching them past Arizona 5-1. He's 8-3 for Houston with an ERA of 2.38.
Mostly cloudy tonight. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows from 57 in northwest Arkansas to around 63 for the Arkansas River Valley. Sunshine tomorrow. Highs from the upper 70s to lower 80s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy. Lows from 58 to 63. This is Ozarks at Large. Tuesday, the last votes in the Arkansas primary were cast in party runoffs. Republican voters selected Leslie Rutledge as their nominee for Attorney General. She'll face Democrat Nate Steele and Libertarian Aaron Cash in November. In another closely watched race in north central Arkansas, Scott Flippo defeated John Burris for the GOP nomination in the State Senate District 17 race. There is no Democrat running, so Scott Flippo will join the State Senate. Roby Brock with Talk Business and Politics is with me on the phone from Little Rock. And Roby, not to diminish an attorney general's race, but a lot of eyes were on that State Senate District 17 race, weren't they?
They were, because how difficult it may be to reauthorize the funding for the private option or make changes to the private option was really kind of hanging in the balance with that Senate seat. John Burris, who was the state representative from the Harrison area, lost that race to Scott Filippo, as you indicated. Burris was one of the chief architects of the private option, and Filippo basically campaigned on a promise to oppose it and do what he could to defund it. And so now that vote is in the state Senate, where there really wasn't any room for error or margin for error. And so it kind of remains to be seen. There's still a lot of time between now and next January, and quite frankly, those votes probably won't come until, you know, as late as April. There'll be a lot more data that gets processed in terms of determining the fate of the private option, but that certainly does not bode well for supporters of it with John Burris's defeat.
Yes, this was one swath, one state Senate district that includes Boone and Marion and part of Baxter County, North Central Arkansas. Is there a danger in extrapolating this one race's result statewide?
Yeah, I don't think that you can paint the broad brush of this is where the electorate is. I mean, if you look at that particular Senate district, too, as you mentioned, from Boone to Baxter County, I'll just give you a little context and your listeners a little context. Asa Hutchinson won 70% to 30% over Curtis Coleman in the GOP governor's primary. The only county that Curtis Coleman won in the state of Arkansas was Baxter County. So there is a ultra-conservatism in that particular region of the state that I don't think exists in some other places across Arkansas. So I think to look at that state Senate district, put it in the context of the whole state, is not a real accurate picture of where state public sentiment is on either the private option or a myriad of other potential issues.
Looking at some statewide races, of course, Tom Cotton running for Senate against incumbent Mark Pryor. A lot of money has been thrown into this already. No indication that there's any lack of money yet. I mean, the money keeps flowing in.
It's going to keep flowing in, Kyle, because this race is competitive, and it is one of just a handful at the national level that is going to see just all eyes of the nation on what happens in this Senate race. And it's a competitive race. I mean, we get a poll one day that shows one candidate up by a little bit, another poll with another candidate up by a little bit. Occasionally you get an outlier that shows a big lead for one or the other. But I think when you take them on average, this race is definitely a 2-3-4 point race at this juncture. And that's going to mean that money comes in and comes flowing in. And I will say that we saw money play in a bunch of other races, too. The attorney general's race, there was a Supreme Court race. We're seeing it in the governor's race. I predict it will be flowing in the congressional races as well. And I think some of that is because these third-party groups and the way that they are structured now, this is all a result of the 2010 Citizens United ruling. I think that those third-party groups have their sea legs now. They understand how to work the system very, very well. I could not get any significant information on who was behind the Judicial Crisis Network's financial contributions that were benefiting David Sterling and blistering Leslie Rutledge. It just was impossible. And I contacted that organization. I asked for interviews. I did as much internet research as you possibly can. And you just can't figure out where the money comes from. And that's legal. And with that kind of setup, you're going to see people take advantage of a system that may not be fair, but is certainly legal. And they're going to push it to the limits. And so I think we're going to see that dark money, that special interest money, really play much more significantly. And I think at some point in time, there is going to have to be some action on that front, maybe not to curtail the contributions, which would be idealistic, but for sure to cure some transparency in that process. And I don't think that's asking too much.
It's called dark money for a reason, right? There is no light being shed upon it.
You're right. I mean, it is very unclear where the money is coming from. And it is very difficult, and it's quite frustrating, to be honest with you. I think that, you know, people have the right to know who's financing some of this stuff. An organization called Arkansans for Great Government or For the Best Arkansas doesn't really tell you anything about where that money comes from, and it's frustrating, and I think it's frustrating to voters.
Finally, we had one of the biggest political upsets in decades this week in Virginia. What do you take away from that, whether as someone who covers politics or what it might mean, if anything, for Arkansas? Any thoughts about Eric Cantor's stunning defeat?
Yeah, I've been poking around on that for the better part of the day today, and I think it's still really fluid right now. I don't think it changes the congressional calendar much at all, and there has been some suggestion that that may happen. I think that we were kind of headed for a stalemate on most of the big issues for the rest of this year anyway, and as dysfunctional as Congress is, I don't hold a lot of hope that they make big movement on big issues. But I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is it's going to embolden some of the Tea Party conservatives that are out there that, hey, look, it is possible. You've got a lot of David versus Goliath races at times out here. And so I think that this is definitely going to be one of those illustrations that's pointed to on a frequent basis. See, it can happen. From what I can learn from some of the congressional sources I've been talking to, Cantor was very out of touch with his district. We've seen this happen in Arkansas in years gone by. I could harken back to the Bill Alexander days when Blanche Lincoln upset him back for Congress in the 90s, or Burl Anthony losing a race in the 4th congressional district back in the day. And that happens when you don't spend enough time in your district. And from what I've heard, Cantor was traveling quite a bit as House Majority Leader, perhaps laying the foundation for a House Speakership position in the near future. And when you miss some of those banquets that you're expected to be at, some of those social events in a congressional district, if you're not there and people notice you're not there, it does start to attract some traction after a while. And I think that's the biggest issue of what happened to him. I'm not sure there's a larger example or lesson to be learned other than for Arkansas politicians to spend time in their districts and listen to their constituents.
Roby Brock is the editor and publisher of Talk Business and Politics. You can see him on television, you can read the quarterly magazine, and you can find out more online at talkbusiness.net. Roby, thanks so much.
Always good to be with you, Kyle.
How about a preview of a story about a preview of an event tomorrow night?
But we've all been talking about what best serves the play. It's not about my ego or Tlaloc's ego or Helen's, ego. It's what will best serve the audience. It's really about thinking about who's going to receive the gift. I think you can't build, as an artist, you can't make something happen like in the arts without being conscious of who's going to be opening their hands.
Last night, we attended a discussion of the play Just Like Us. It looks at the immigration status of 4 young females. A staged reading will take place tomorrow evening at Theater Squared. We'll have a summary of last night's discussion in just about half an hour on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Economist Milton Esrati says an aging population is the most serious challenge the U.S. faces in the next 30 years.
We will have a shortage of producing, taxpaying, pension-contributing people. It's going to strain our finances, and it will also challenge the economy.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Listen this afternoon from 1 to 3 to 91.3 FM.
Usually when we search for the meaning behind a name of some place or something for our What's in a Name series, we find out history or legend plays a heavy influence. Buildings may be named for an iconic member of the community, towns for a geographical feature or founder. Sometimes, though, a name has to be created out of more or less pure imagination.
I must admit, we spent much less time coming up with the title than we did talking about the content of the magazine.
Lynn Wasson is managing editor and co-publisher of the magazine Entertainment Fort Smith, often called E. Fort Smith. Naming a magazine is, in some ways, the same as selecting a name for a new park or a campus building. Those responsible seek an appropriate title reflecting the essence of what's inside. But a magazine is a commercial endeavor, and that title may or may not help a new enterprise succeed.
We came up with Entertainment Fort Smith because we thought entertainment encompassed what we were trying to say about our content. But my goodness, for logo purposes, it certainly is a long word.
So Lynn Wasson and co-publisher Linda Siebold quickly decided 15 years ago that they could condense Entertainment Fort Smith to E Fort Smith. And if you remember, the letter E was pretty hot in the late 90s and early 2000s.
15 years ago, which seems archaic now in the digital age, there were two things competing to symbolize that something was connected to the internet. One was the letter E, as in email or e-books. And for some aesthetic reason, we just thought E was more interesting. At the time we were choosing our name, we looked through the dictionary for words that begin with E and thought, could we make a play off of that letter, you know, being E for, at the time, electronic.
And that name has worked, 15 years and counting. While nationally magazines have been disappearing, regionally they've been appearing. There are stalwarts like AY Magazine, Cityscapes, and Celebrate, but also more recent additions like To Enjoy, Current Land, and Idle Class. 3W Magazine has been publishing its annual journal cataloging charitable social events for several years. Leslie Zanoff is a co-founder of 3W Magazine. She says the name is inspired by the old journalism axiom of the five W's: who, what, where, when, and why. Though not everybody reaches that conclusion immediately.
We get a lot of people asking if 3W stands for three women, and it doesn't. It's just Casey and myself that started the magazine. So yes, 3W stands for the who, what, where.
Leslie says it took at least a couple of months of list making and brainstorming to come to an agreement on what the venture should be called. 3W is also inspired by a national approach to a charitable events registry. She says now the concept of the who, what, and where of philanthropy in Northwest Arkansas, 3W, serves as a template for what should or should not be included in the pages of the magazine.
All of our editorial, it has to do with giving back and volunteering and philanthropist in Northwest Arkansas. If it doesn't kind of fit into that category, then it's not in the magazine. It's not in print. But other than that, for the calendar of dates of all the community events that are happening. So for the editorial, though, yes. It's not about giving back or volunteering. It's not in the magazine.
The most familiar magazines have names that have remained the same for years. Sports Illustrated, Cosmopolitan, Better Homes and Gardens have been published with those names for decades. Though Cosmopolitan's first issues in the 1880s were under the name The Cosmopolitan. Sometimes, however, the first name doesn't quite fit. Catherine Frederick is the editor-in-chief of Due South Magazine in Fort Smith.
Well, you know, some of our readers remember when we first started back in 2010, we were actually known as Ad Urban. And that's how we started. We really thought we were going to be a magazine of and about the city, and we are. But we quickly figured out by the stories that we told, we were anything but urban. You know, we went back and looked at all the stories that we had been writing, and the common thread through all of them was our southern roots.
Some of the covers of the magazine when it was called At Urban: a barn on the cover of the September 2013 issue, and a rooster the month before that. So Catherine and Marla Cantrell, the managing editor of what is now called Due South, schemed to come up with something that was more inclusive, covering what happens inside the city limits, but also throughout the region. Marla says the current name came from a desire to reflect the content and to serve as an internal mission statement.
We're both Southern girls, and we felt like that we weren't really urban after we had done this for a little while. And yes, it's a mission statement. We love everything about the South. We think we're good storytellers. We want to tell those stories. We want to connect to Arkansas. That's why we use the Arkansas logo a lot. So yes, it's absolutely a mission statement for us.
The new name, Due South, works for Marla and Catherine in many ways. The Due is D-O, so headlines can be a sort of call to action. And the pun of Due South, D-U-E, allows for a reinforcement of the magazine's target subjects.
You know, when we first started looking at changing the name, it was a very big decision for us. We looked at, we knew South had to be in the name. It was who we were. We looked at different names. We looked at Southbound because we like that. We like the idea. But we didn't want people to confuse us with a travel magazine. So when we looked at Due and Due, D-U-E, could have gone either way. But really, we liked the kind of double entendre there that we could, you know, take the word Due and use it in so many different forms throughout the magazine every month. You know, do our DIY, do make our recipe. And then, like you said, Due South, D-U-E, you know, do travel.
Everybody asked about their magazine for this story stressed the name is important. But even the best name can't carry you for more than a few issues without two things: great content and a great roster of contributors. After all, once the name's in place, you have to fill the pages with words and pictures that bring people back. Lynn Wasson with Entertainment Fort Smith says, in an age when mobile screens can bring us images and content of almost everything, a physical magazine not only represents information, but a chance to unwind.
The experience of holding a magazine with one or both hands encourages someone to sit down in a quiet place and put their feet up and devote minutes of their attention and enjoyment to reading. And who would have thought? That sounds like stating the obvious. But when you are reading on a digital screen, you could have an infinite number of other things distracting you. I know I do.
And as far as names, each publisher or editor included in this edition of our What's in a Name series had favorite magazine titles of their own, names they think are spot on for the publications they represent.
Garden and Gun.
Real simple, and I'm feeling like I need to simplify my life that month, and that looks good to me too and sounds good.
The two best magazine names in the world, Time and Life.
If you have a question about why something in our area bears the name it does and want to know the story behind that name, let us know. You can email your suggestions for a future What's in a Name story to us at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night from 10 till midnight. On this Friday's program, I'll interview Yellow Jackets drummer Will Kennedy. Will talks about growing up in Oakland, California, in what was known as the East Bay Grease music scene with the likes of Sly Stone and Tower of Power, on to his touring the world with the Yellow Jackets. All this and more on Shades of Jazz this Friday at 10 p.m. right here on KUAF.
A new study by marketing researcher Robin Soster at the University of Arkansas, in collaboration with colleagues from University of Texas at Austin and University of South Carolina, uses virtual dollars and short films to confirm the so-called bottom dollar effect, which is when a consumer's satisfaction for a product decreases as the consumer's budget is exhausted. I asked Robin Soster if she would like to come to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss her work. You bet your bottom dollar she did.
That's actually, believe it or not, an idiom that started in the United States, bet your bottom dollar. And basically it meant who would take the bet. If you push all your chips into the bet, you're only going to do that if you know the outcome is going to be positive, right? And so it does kind of relate to this, because what we're saying is when people spend their bottom dollars, that they actually are less satisfied with the product. So yes, I would say that it definitely ties into our bottom dollar effect, because your expectations, perhaps, when you put in that last money, is that you better get a good outcome from spending your bottom dollar.
What happens if you don't get a good outcome?
Well, so in all of our studies, we actually had very positive products. And we just saw a decrease in satisfaction for positive products. We haven't tested it for things that people didn't like. So based on our theory, my prediction would be that people would like it less, right? They would be even more frustrated if they got a bad outcome and had spent their last dollar on something. But we don't know. We haven't tested that yet. That's so, on the horizon.
So you looked at fun things. One of the things I saw cited was a movie.
Right. So for most of our studies, we actually had people earn money that they spent in an online film festival. And so we showed them some really great two-minute films. And so they would purchase the film, they would watch the film. Immediately after watching it, they would tell us what they thought about it, if they liked the movie, things like that. And then they would go on and purchase another film. So we had a series of purchases where they bought really some pretty fun films that they watched, and everyone saw the same film. The people who had spent the last of their credits that they had earned liked the film less than people that had enough credits left to purchase another movie after viewing that one.
Interesting.
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we think it's kind of an interesting effect. I mean, it does feel differently if you pull out your wallet and you're spending the very last of what you have, right? I don't know about you, but I try to keep some cash on hand. And spending the last of that money means that I don't have it anymore. So our theory, and we tested this, and this is what happened, actually, was that it hurt more. Psychological pain of putting down your very last dollar, it felt worse than spending that wasn't that last bit.
Well, I know, you know, like paying the water bill when you only have, you know, maybe $50, and then having to pay that water bill, and then you have nothing. You know, I mean, that's not a fun purchase like the movie
right,
that you were talking
right.
about, but it's a necessary purchase. I mean, I'm not going to get any satisfaction out of that, well, like whatsoever.
My co-author, Andy Gershoff, and I always talk about the fact that it might work differently for those things that we need. So we did look at hedonic purchases, which a lot of marketing researchers look at these types of purchases. But we have also discussed those purchases that bring you kind of just to neutral. So buying tires for your car, right? You just need those. It's not something fun. It's not, you're not getting any benefit. I mean, you are getting a benefit, but you're not feeling the pleasure of that consumption. So we tried to look at things where there was some sort of pleasurable consumption so that we could have, so that we could look at satisfaction, right? Everyone, when they pay their utility bill, they're probably not going to say, I feel fantastic about this water that I will receive this month, right?
Right. Totally not. Well, so you found a group and organized this kind of online way to pay them and then
right,
ways
exactly.
for them to spend their money.
So this was kind of an interesting thing about our research. A lot of marketing researchers will look at kind of scenario-based studies. So you'll tell people a story and you'll ask them, oh, what would you choose? Or how do you think you would feel about that transaction? We, and that's a problem. We really wanted to test satisfaction. You can't test satisfaction by asking someone, do you think you would like this movie? So we came up with a protocol in which we had people do tasks and they earned credits for this film buying festival. Then they spent them. Then they rated the movie. And that actually hasn't been done a lot in the field where people really measure satisfaction. You know, not these broad surveys with J.D. Power. Clearly they're measuring satisfaction. But this was in the moment how they felt about a product that they had just purchased. And we recruited participants from an online panel. And so they did a survey online to earn the money and watch the movies.
Did you find that if somebody only had, I mean, I don't know how much the movies cost or how much money they had, but if somebody only had $4 and the movie cost $3.50, that they're less inclined to spend that $3.50? Did anybody hold on to that $3.50?
So in our studies, they weren't given the choice. Mm-hmm. Other research has looked at people's propensity to spend the last of their resources. So there have been some findings that have shown that you're less likely to spend on non-necessities between paychecks. You get your paycheck, you spend on these fun things. In between paychecks, slowly your consumption decreases of those types of things. So we actually didn't have them get right to the, you know, we didn't leave them with 50 cents in their pocket. We could test that. I mean, that's something that, you know, future researchers might want to look at. Where is that inflection point? Do I have to have enough left to make another movie purchase? Or just does having some sort of resource in my pocket make me at least feel like I've got something I can spend in the future?
Well, I know. I mean, when I get paid, I definitely go down my list and, you know, I mean, I pay all my bills, but then I do some fun things too. You know, I'll go and, I don't know, buy makeup or, you know, I mean, things that aren't necessary.
Right.
And I mean, towards the end of the month, I'm not doing that quite so much. But it does make getting paid that much more fun.
For sure, right? We haven't looked at the top dollar effect.
Is that what that is? Okay.
Maybe. That's another thing we've talked about. Is it possible that you would just enjoy it so much more because it's not painful at all making that purchase because you're flush. You've got a ton of resources. What we do show in our studies is there was no difference in satisfaction between the top dollar spending and the spending right before running out. It was only in those cases where we ran out that it was, you know, that it fell down. Now, that might be because our movies that we got were really just fun and creative and, you know, arty.
So we didn't look at, say, I get paid on Friday and it's Tuesday and, okay, I decide I can go to the movies on Tuesday because I know I'm getting paid on Friday.
Right. So we tested that too. So we looked at people that were running out and we told them they were getting more money in their budget the next day. And for those people, the bottom dollar effect did go away. They weren't as concerned because they knew, hey, tomorrow I'm going to get more. Interestingly, for people that had money, when we told them they were getting paid a week later, they actually started behaving like the people that were spending their last dollars, you know? So they were thinking, wait a second, I've got to make this money remaining in my budget last for a week. I've just spent a good bit of it today. How am I going to be able to do that? So we actually show that you're right. When we know we're getting paid, we can kind of erase that bottom dollar effect from our minds because I know I'm going to get more resources. It's imminent.
Well, and so as marketers, is it better maybe to try to diminish that bottom dollar effect and maybe promote something around payday?
Yeah, so one definite implication for marketers that are trying to sell a product, if, for example, it's a new product, you want people to have a really positive feeling after they consume it. So they'll tell people, you know, word of mouth, and so they'll buy it again. And so one thing about that is if you can really advertise the product heavily, perhaps, at the beginning of the month when we're flush or when we have a lot of money to spend, or right around when people get back their tax money, right, the refunds, that's a good time to promote the product just through advertising. Get people to buy the product. Towards the end of the month or maybe the 15th, it kind of depends on your customer, people tend to start running out of money. At that point, maybe offering coupons or promotions of percents off of the price, at least it would lessen the pain, which is what drives this bottom dollar effect. It lessens the pain of parting with the money if you're getting a good deal on the purchase.
Were people less likely to spend the next time?
We actually looked at how long it took them to choose the movie that they chose. They all had to purchase the movie. And, you know, really, when you run experiments like that, for control purposes, at least in most of our experiments, we had them earn credits that could only be used in the film festival. So we didn't have people that were like, oh, I'm going to hang on to these credits because I'll use them for nothing, right? But it does suggest that you would be less likely to spend just because it hurts to spend, right? So you would rather hold on to that money.
Well, you mentioned, before we started recording, the $4 that you had for the coffee.
Right.
And, you know, the next time you only have $4 in your pocket, do you think about that a little bit? Do you consider it a little bit longer? Like, I really want this coffee?
So that's an excellent question because we haven't looked at that. But it's kind of the same thing from a managerial perspective. If your satisfaction is low, you might not be likely to buy the product again. It might hurt your loyalty to the brand if this time, for some reason, and you just can't put your finger on it, you like the product less. So it should make you less likely to spend. Maybe it would make you try a different product that time. Maybe instead of the latte, which, you know, a latte that costs $4 and I spent my last $4, maybe it tasted not as good to me for some reason. So maybe the next time I get, you know, a Mayan mocha.
Or just a plain coffee.
Or just a plain coffee, right. And I've got my $2 that I can spend on something else.
Right. Why has this not really been researched very much before?
So I think part of it is this protocol we came up with where people actually earned the resources and spent them. People haven't tried it like that. And a lot of this research, this area, it's called mental accounting. And it's about psychological accounts that you create. So it's very tough to test. It's very tough to ask people, why do you like this less? Why would you behave differently? Because it's all mental accounts. So it's very hard for them to put their finger on exactly why they feel the way they feel. So a lot of the research in this area has been done through scenario-based studies where they might say Mr. A spent his last $4 on a latte. Mr. B still had $4 after he bought his latte. Who do you think is happier, Mr. A or Mr. B? It should be Mr. B. But the research has really looked more at choice and decision instead of this very important downstream consequence, which is well-being or satisfaction with the product, loyalty, likelihood to repurchase, things like that. And actually, one of my co-authors, Bill Bearden, is quite an expert in this area. So it kind of makes sense that we're looking at this satisfaction as our measure that we're most interested in.
Robin Soster is an assistant professor of marketing in the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas.
The sun will come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. Just thinking about tomorrow.
This is Ozarks at Large. Tonight, the 2014 Arkansas New Play Festival, presented by Theater Squared, opens with a presentation of Beside Myself. You may remember last year we had a series of reports about the script's development from a first read with a brand new cast to its script in hand reading that took place at George's Majestic Lounge. Tonight, an even more realized version will be staged at Nadine Baum Studios at 7. Tomorrow night, the in-progress play, Just Like Us, will be presented at Nadine Baum, beginning at 6. That play is based on the book of the same name by journalist Helen Thorpe. It's a true story about four Latina girls and how their immigration status begins to alter their friendships as they go to college in Colorado. Last night at the Fayetteville Public Library, the playwright, Karen Zacharias, and the director, Falak Rivas, joined me for a public discussion about the play. Here's an excerpt from that conversation, which also included Bob Ford, the artistic director for Theater Squared. I asked Karen Zacharias how she converts a best-selling nonfiction work of nearly 400 pages to the stage.
The first thing you do is you read the book, and they say they want an adaptation, and you shut yourself in your room, and you cry, and you think, it's not possible. It's not possible. And you go back, and you say to them, I don't think it's possible. And they say, no, I think you can find a way in. And so you know what you do? You break the rules. All those rules you have in your head about how a play should sound and how it should feel and whatever they taught you in school, you just say, how would I tell this story to my children? And I started, well, Helen Thorpe, who is the reporter here, this is all coming through her eyes. I think I'm going to do a big taboo and have her be a narrator. And everyone gasped, like, no, you can't have a narrator, that you don't do that in the theater. And I said, there's no other way to tell this story, because this is the woman who's married to the mayor of Denver, that later on became the governor, and she's also in the public schools of Denver. It's too hard to travel all of those different classes and stories without having someone guide us there. So that's how I started. And Helen Thorpe was not excited about the idea, but she agreed. She said, you know, I think it's the only way to tell the story.
You mentioned the rules, and do you think that playwrights are much more conscious of these rules than potential audience members?
I think we are, because we're not writers, we are architects. A play has to work in three dimensions. It doesn't work on paper. You have to think of how it's wrought in a way. And so that means that you have to have a certain idea of space and time and actors. It's an interpretive art. Helen gets to talk to you, straight to you. I don't. I have the pleasure of having actors, directors, designers help interpret my story. So I have to give them the what's that called? When you do architecture?
Blueprint.
Blueprint, thank you. The blueprint for how we're going to build this play together. It's a community work doing theater, and so I'm just the architect, but the contractor and all the workers, they're the ones who really need to deliver.
I was going to go with that metaphor myself. If you're the architect and the contractor is the director, let's bring in the contractor.
Yes.
So this is not a blank canvas when it comes to you as far as words, but it is as far as a physical 3D event. Mm-hmm. With the sounds, where do you begin?
I guess for me personally, I start with the audience and placing myself in the audience's shoes and what will they experience moment to moment. Certainly, the first thing that leaps off the page is what kind of tone and what kind of rhythm is this play going to take us? Who's going to be our window character into the world of the play? And so, with the assistance of the theater in terms of casting, we try to fill those voices that are inherent in the play. And this ensemble of nine actors play, they double and triple as different characters in this particular play. What's really interesting is that there was a previous version of this play that had 19 actors in its initial production at the Denver Center. So the challenge was, in order to give this play a future life, was to reduce the ensemble to 9 actors, but also playing multiple roles and the more essential roles in the play. So that's been my role, and to just offer my own sort of thoughts and feedback and counsel when working with Karen, just to kind of try some ideas. And since we have the actors in the room, we're able to kind of experiment and explore and use improv to kind of inspire either new scenes, new dialogue, or whatever.
But what is the, is it an exponential, a potential exponential growth when, as opposed to writing, reading, having someone else read, but then to have actors bring it to life? Can things change much faster?
Absolutely. I brought in on Monday 3 different beginnings, and then today I ran in 2 different endings. Whether people live or die depends on how the actors. And Tlaloc got the actors on their feet, and we read it, and because they are inside their characters, they can tell me, this does not feel like my character would say this. They're living in these people's shoes, and I'm on the outside, actually. So they've been instrumental, Tlaloc and the actors, and we also have had a wonderful dramaturg in the room. And a dramaturg is what I call a therapist for plays, and Megan has been exceptional in helping us, but we've all been talking about what best serves the play. It's not about my ego or Tlaloc's ego or Helen's, you know, ego. It's what will best serve the audience. It's really about thinking about who's going to receive the gift. I think you can't build, as an artist, you can't make something happen like in the arts without being conscious of who's going to be opening their hands.
Karen Zacharias is the playwright and Tlaloc Rivas, the director for the work in progress, Just Like Us, based on the nonfiction book by Helen Thorpe. The reading of the play is tomorrow night at 6 at Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville. It's part of Theater Square's 2014 Arkansas New Play Festival. There's much going on in that festival. To see a list of all the plays and all the events associated with the festival, which begins tonight, you can go to theater2.org. That's the numeral 2, theater2.org. Last night's public conversation about Just Like Us was at the Fayetteville Public Library and part of the library's author series.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We are previewing the 2014 Riverfront Blues Festival in Fort Smith, Arkansas, in Harry E. Kelly Park. That's Friday and Saturday, June 20th and 21st. I'll be playing some selections from this year's performers, J.P. Soares, Little Ed and the Blues Imperials, Samantha Fish, and Paul Thorne. Again, that's the Generic Blue Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
It is Thursday, June 12th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Another sure bet in Fayetteville in the summer and a thing I love, it's Gully Park Concert Series time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tonight is Waylon Pierce, who is friends with people like Dwight Yoakam and George Strait, has had several singles on the Texas music chart, and he will perform at 7 o'clock tonight in the free concert series. Also coming up on June 26th, Gouda.
Mm-hmm.
On July 10th, Boom Kinetic.
Fun.
On July 24th, Sarah and the Meanies, about whom I know nothing but I love the name. And August 7th, the Ben Miller Band. Always on Thursdays, always at 7, always in Gully Park in Fayetteville, and always free. Also free, the Fayetteville Public Library Summer Music Series, which has been extended through July this year. Yes, this is my current favorite thing to tell you about. It's free. It happens at 2 o'clock Sundays in the Walker Community Room, so it's air-conditioned. You can get a little snack at our Segas.
Sure.
Everybody's happy. Next week is Got It Covered. On June 22nd, Dave Bear. June 29th, Snake Eyes and the Bug Band.
Mm-hmm.
July 6th, Mood Indigo. July 13th, Cindy Wolf and Mark Bilyeu. July 20th, Candy Lee and the Sweets. And wrapping it up on July 27th, Barrett Baber.
Oh, that's a pretty good list there.
Kind of an amazing lineup for free on Sunday afternoon. Take the kids, buy them some snacks, healthy snacks. How good is that?
That's great.
Buy a cup of coffee and have a great time. I'll see you there.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Montanay.
Montanay.
Yep.
Both the above water and the below water.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple things I want to mention. Earlier today, it was announced that Jim Lauderdale, the Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter who worked with Ralph Stanley, that's why he won his Grammy, is coming to George's Majestic Lounge Friday, June 20th. It's a presentation of the Roots Festival, which, of course, happens later in August. Doors that night at 8:45. He'll start playing music at 9:15.
That is just next week.
Yeah. So get on it.
Yeah.
Secondly, BuzzFeed, that thing that can eat up your
evening.
Lists
and things.
They came out with a list recently, the 17 bookstores that they say will literally change your life. 17 bookstores from around the world. London, Netherlands, Brazil, Venice, Buenos Aires, Brussels, Portugal, Mexico City, Greece, China, Singapore. 5 from the U.S. made that list of 17. The last bookstore in L.A., Brattle Bookshop in Boston, City Lights, of course, in San Francisco, Powell's, of course, in Portland, and little old Fayetteville, Dixon Street Bookshop.
Of course. It's a good bookstore.
It's a fantastic bookstore. It's the magic bookstore.
Yeah, we're lucky.
We are.
I'd like to give a shout out to the Woodland Junior High School Quiz Bowl team.
Absolutely.
I spoke with them earlier this year. I can't remember. It was winter, spring.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier this year, as they were preparing to go to their state championship. But they won nationals, which is just crazy.
Amazing.
Yeah. They came in first out of 25 teams. So
from the entire country.
Right.
So I bet some of them have spent time at the Dixon Street Bookstore.
I bet some of them have.
I bet they have.
So congratulations to them.
Yes.
All right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Karnatz.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
We will end today's show with a little bit of music from Andrew Bird. He's one of my favorites. I love listening to him on Sunday mornings, actually. He will be at Kane's Ballroom Sunday evening. So Kane's Ballroom is in Tulsa. For tickets, you can go to kanesballroom.com. This is Andrew Bird's song, If I Needed You.